Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. On the show today, Joel Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. We also hear reports from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. We close the show with American Story, After 20 Years, by O. Henry. But first, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party have won a big victory in general elections. Results show the Conservatives won a clear majority of the 650 seats in Parliament. Johnson is now likely to act on his promise to lead Britain out of the European Union. The country is set to withdraw from the EU by January 31st, the latest time limit set by the two sides. However, British negotiators will have much work to do to reach a trade deal with Europe before that date. Johnson has stated that Britain will withdraw from the EU, a move known as Brexit, with or without a deal in place. It has been more than 3 years since Britons decided in a special referendum to separate from the EU. Political observers say it is likely that voters on Thursday, even those who wanted to stay with the EU, had grown tired of the issue and political indecision. Before the vote, Johnson had a simple message: get Brexit done. The message was designed to win votes. During the election campaign, the Prime Minister tried to avoid answering reporters' questions. His actions led to criticism in the media, but clearly did not hurt him and other Conservative candidates. The Associated Press notes that the Labour Party, led by Jeremy Corbyn, struggled to find a message to appeal to voters. Corbyn was seen as unsure about whether he supported Brexit or not. He was criticized for failing to take steps to deal with reports of anti-Semitism in his party. He also failed to gain support for costly socialist reforms. Corbyn has said he will not lead the Labour Party into another election, but has not offered to step down immediately. In addition to the Conservatives, the National Party of Scotland was another big winner in the elections. The party won 48 seats in Parliament, 13 more than it had before. Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's first minister, said the election gave her a renewed mandate to push for another vote on Scottish independence. A vote on independence failed in 2014. Johnson has said he opposes another referendum on Scotland. In Northern Ireland, the pro-Britain Democratic Unionist Party lost 2 of its 10 seats in the election. The party's leader, Arlene Foster, blamed Irish nationalist parties for the defeat. The vote showed strong support for Brexit, but the Brexit Party of Nigel Farage did not win any seats. The party decided against nominating candidates for 317 Conservative-held seats to avoid splitting the pro-Brexit vote. Farage said he would rather his party not win seats than have a second referendum on Brexit. Johnson's success did not seem possible only a few weeks ago. His first 3 months in office were marked by defeats in Parliament and in the courts. This summer, after the Prime Minister sought to have Parliament suspended in order to push through Brexit, the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom ruled the move illegal. He was then forced to ask the EU for more time beyond October 31st to work toward a Brexit agreement. Johnson then took a chance by supporting calls for general elections in an effort to gain public support and allies to pass Brexit legislation.
This week, United States President Donald Trump signed an executive order aimed at fighting anti-Semitism at universities and colleges across the country. The measure interprets part of a U.S. civil rights law to include members of a group that shares common religious practices. Part of the law bars discrimination based on race, color, and national origin in federally supported programs. The Trump administration said it will, as a policy, extend protections under the law to Jewish people. Some major Jewish organizations praised the action. They said it means that universities could lose federal money if they do not stop discrimination against Jews at their schools. Rabbi Abraham Cooper is with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, a Jewish rights organization. He said, "This is a very critically important move that will set an environment wherein Jewish students who were targeted with anti-Semitism on university campuses in America will actually have protection and recourse." Cooper added that he believed the issue had support in both major political parties. "This is not a Republican or a Democratic issue," he said. Other Americans, however, said they were unsure about recognizing Jews as a national group. Molly Jong Fast is a Jewish American writer and a critic of Trump. She says Jewishness is not a nationality. "I am an American because that's where I live," she said. Jong Fast told VOA that she believes Trump is, in her words, very anti-Semitic. But Matt Brooks, president of the Republican Jewish Coalition, disagrees. He says Trump's executive order was meant to protect Jewish people. He said that some organizations and activists who oppose Trump are having a hard time explaining the president's action to defend the Jewish community from anti-Semitism. The executive order triggers Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That law requires colleges and other educational organizations that receive federal money not to discriminate based on race, color, or national origin. Religion is not covered under the Civil Rights Act. Administration officials say they decided to interpret Judaism as a nationality so that violations at colleges could be punished. Officials said that Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh students already are protected from discrimination under Title VI of the law. They said that is because of the shared ancestry and ethnic qualities that each group has. On Wednesday, President Trump signed the order at a ceremony marking the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah at the White House. He called the order a very powerful document. Some opponents of the measure worry that it could limit freedom of speech at schools. They say it could be used to stop criticism of Israel's policies toward Palestinians. Jeremy Ben Ami is president of J Street, a nonprofit group that deals with Jewish issues. He said the executive order appears designed less to fight anti-Semitism than to limit free speech and hurt critics of Israel. Also criticizing the order was the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. It said the action will lead to abuse of federal funding to limit academic freedom and Palestinian rights. The American Civil Liberties Union called the order unnecessary. It said the protection already exists under Title VI. The group's national legal director, David Cole, said the government cannot equate speech criticizing Israel with unlawful discrimination. Anti-Israel feelings have increased at U.S. colleges and universities. The Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement has organized events targeting the Jewish state. Some of those events have led to harassment of Jewish students. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
A new car racing track is nearing completion in Hanoi, Vietnam. The Formula One website reports that crews are expected to finish work on the race course next month. The international racing event is making preparations for the country's first Formula One Grand Prix. The race is to take place in April. The Vietnam Grand Prix Circuit, or raceway, is 5.6 kilometers in length. It was designed to include a permanent track structure, but also extends into some of Hanoi's streets. Formula One says it expects drivers to reach top speeds of about 335 kilometers an hour. Asia experts say Formula One's arrival in Vietnam demonstrates the economic health of the communist-led country. The Grand Prix races are expected to bring more foreigners into Vietnam. Rajiv Biswas is the chief Asia-Pacific economist at market research company IHS Markit. He told VOA He thinks the government will use Formula One events to expand the country's tourism industry. Then, of course, Vietnam's own more upper-middle-class population would be interested in these types of events, he added. Liam Parker is head of communications for Formula One. He says one reason the organization chose Vietnam was because of major growth in its increasingly market-driven economy. The country enjoys a growing local population with a large and young workforce and higher personal earnings, Parker told VOA. Hanoi is one of the most exciting cities in the world right now, with such a rich history and an incredible future ahead of it, he added. This is the perfect formula for Grand Prix racing, and we believe this will become a real highlight of the F1 calendar. Between 2010 and 2018, the number of foreign tourists in Vietnam expanded from 5 million to more than 15 million. Vietnamese officials expect the Formula One event to bring in even more tourists, said Mark Thomas, an advisor with sports marketing company Omnicom Experiential Group. I sort of think it works for both sides, Thomas said. He explained that the government gets a new way to advertise Vietnam to the world, while Formula One and its owners make money from the deal. Vietnam, like China 15 years ago, is an up-and-coming nation that wants to showcase itself to the world, Thomas added. Around East Asia, Formula One holds other races in China, Japan, and Singapore. More than one-third of Vietnam's 97 million people will be middle class or more by next year, the Boston Consulting Group predicts. The middle class growth is fueled mainly by a rise in export manufacturing that has created jobs. More Vietnamese now have money to attend live sporting events. Soccer and basketball have both gained popularity in recent years. A Formula One Grand Prix ticket will cost between $30 to $300, depending on the event date and seats bought. I'm Brian Lynn.
This week we answer a question from Hamza. She writes, what is the difference between make and do? How and when should I use them? Dear Hamza, make and do are similar verbs in English. There are some words that go together with make and others that go together with do. In other words, there are fixed expressions in English with both of these verbs, and you just have to learn them. But there are general rules you can follow. Use make for when you create or produce something. Use do for actions you must do, like jobs or work, and for general activities, especially activities you repeat often. Let's look at some examples of each verb. Here are examples of make for things we produce. These can be something you can touch, like food and drinks. I made a cake for your birthday. Please make some tea before you leave. Sometimes you cannot see or touch the thing that is created. Your dog is making too much noise. We are making progress on our study. She made plans to go to a movie with her sister. Let's look at the use of do for work or jobs. In another Ask a Teacher, we talked about the questions, what do you do? And what are you doing? Here are some examples of using do to talk about work at home. I have to do the planting every fall. Mom says, no TV until you do your homework. Another way to use do is with words like something, anything, and nothing. I did not do anything yesterday. Are you doing something interesting over the holiday? The police did nothing to stop the crimes. Next time you are trying to decide between make and do, please keep these rules in mind. The more you listen to and read English, the easier it will be to choose between these verbs. Do you have a question for the VOA English teachers? Please email us with your question. Our email is learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
Now it's time for our program, American Stories. Today we hear After 20 Years by O. Henry. O. Henry wrote the story in the early 1900s. It was first published in a collection of O. Henry stories called The 4 Million.
After 20 years, the cop moved along the street looking strong and important. This was the way he always moved. He was not thinking of how he looked. There were few people on the street to see him. It was only about 10 at night, but it was cold, and there was a wind with a little rain in it. He stopped at doors as he walked along, trying each door to be sure that it was closed for the night. Now and then he turned and looked up and down the street. He was a fine-looking cop, watchful, guarding the peace. People in this part of the city went home early. Now and then you might see the lights of a shop or a small restaurant, but most of the doors belonged to business places that had been closed hours ago. Then the cop suddenly slowed his walk. Near the door of a darkened shop, a man was standing. As the cop walked toward him, the man spoke quickly.
"It's all right, officer," he said. "I'm waiting for a friend. 20 years ago, we agreed to meet here tonight." "It sounds strange to you, doesn't it? I'll explain if you want to be sure that everything's all right. About 20 years ago, there was a restaurant here where this shop stands, Big Joe Brady's Restaurant. It was here until 5 years ago," said the cop.
The man near the door had a colorless, square face with bright eyes and a little white mark near his right eye. He had a large jewel in his necktie.
20 years ago tonight," said the man, "I had dinner here with Jimmy Wells. He was my best friend and the best fellow in the world. He and I grew up together here in New York, like two brothers. I was 18 and Jimmy was 20. The next morning, I was to start for the West. I was going to find a job and make a great success. You couldn't have pulled Jimmy out of New York. He thought it was the only place on earth. We agreed that night that we would meet here again in 20 years. We thought that in 20 years we would know what kind of men we were and what future waited for us." "It sounds interesting," said the cop. "A long time between meetings, it seems to me. Have you heard from your friends since you went west?" "Yes, for a time we did write to each other," said the man. "But after a year or two, we stopped. The west is big. I moved around everywhere, and I moved quickly. but I know that Jimmy will meet me here if he can. He was as true as any man in the world. He'll never forget. I came 1,000 miles to stand here tonight, but I'll be glad about that if my old friend comes too. The man waiting took out a fine watch covered with small jewels. 3 minutes before 10, he said. It was 10 that night when we said goodbye here at the restaurant door. You were successful in the West, weren't you? Asked the cop. I surely was. I hope Jimmy has done half as well. He was a slow mover. I've had to fight for my success. In New York, a man doesn't change much. In the West, you learn how to fight for what you get. The cop took a step or two. I'll go on my way, he said. I hope your friend comes all right. If he isn't here at 10, are you going to leave? I am not, said the other. I'll wait half an hour at least. If Jimmy is alive on this earth, he'll be here by that time. Good night, officer. Good night, said the cop and walked away, trying doors as he went. There was now a cold rain falling and the wind was stronger. The few people walking along that street were hurrying, trying to keep warm. At the door of the shop stood the man who had come 1,000 miles to meet a friend. Such a meeting could not be certain, but he waited. About 20 minutes he waited, and then a tall man in a long coat came hurrying across the street. He went directly to the waiting man.
"Is that you, Bob?"
he asked doubtfully.
"Is that you, Timmy Wells?" cried the man at the door.
The new man took the other man's hand in his.
"It's Bob! It surely is! I was certain I would find you here if you were still alive. 20 years is a long time. The old restaurant is gone, Bob. I wish it were here, so that we could have another dinner in it. Has the West been good to you?"
"They gave me everything I asked for. You've changed, Jimmy. I never thought you were so tall."
"Oh, I grew a little after I was 20.
"Are you doing well in New York, Jimmy?"
"Well enough. I work for the city. Come on, Bob. We'll go to a place I know and have a good long talk about old times."
The two men started along the street arm in arm. The man from the West was beginning to tell the story of his life. The other, with his coat up to his ears, listened with interest. At the corner stood a shop bright with electric lights. When they came near, each turned to look at the other's face. The man from the West stopped suddenly and pulled his arm away.
"You're not Jimmy Wells," he said. 20 years is a long time, but not long enough to change the shape of a man's nose." "It sometimes changes a good man into a bad one," said the tall man. "You've been under arrest for 10 minutes, Bob. Chicago cops thought you might be coming to New York. They told us to watch for you. Are you coming with me quietly?" "That's wise. But first, here's something I was asked to give you. You may read it here at the window. It's from a cop named Wells."
The man from the West opened the little piece of paper. His hand began to shake a little as he read.
"Bob, I was at the place on time. I saw the face of the man wanted by Chicago cops. I didn't want to arrest you myself. So I went and got another cop and sent him to do the job. Jimmy."
You have been listening to The American Short Story, After 20 Years, written by O. Henry. That's all the time we have for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, for more stories from around the world. We want to hear from you. If you have questions or comments about our programs, please send an email to learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.